So I guess Mathieu didn't have to thank the organizers yesterday, but I have to. Yeah, so it's a pleasure to be here already. I'm looking forward to this month. So our module is on mosquitoes, Chris and I, our students. I will not talk about our mosquito work today. Instead, I will talk about this, where the wild flies are, the olfactory neuroecology of Drosophila melanogaster. So I'm at Lund University, that's in Sweden. Until quite recently, I think most Americans had never heard of Sweden. Then your fine president, he had this amazing comment that, look what's happening last night in Sweden, and actually nothing at all happened in Sweden. So I think for that was the first time most Americans heard of our little country. Okay, so nevertheless, here I am.
Where is it?
Yeah, it's close to the North Pole. That's where Santa Claus lives, and we have polar bears this week. So I will talk about this critter, the vinegar fly, the fruit fly, Drosophila melanogaster, favorite model organism. And I was introduced yesterday. So the meeting here is the neurophysics of sensory navigation. I will must confess I will go easy on the physics part and also on the navigation part. So it's neuro of sensory. The dates are correct, and so is the web address, I think. I hope you don't mind. I think it's better for everyone if I stay far away from physics. Yeah. Okay, so here is a fly in its, let's say, natural environment. The fly, like many other organisms, has to accomplish a number of tasks. One of them being finding food. Second important thing is avoiding danger. And I'm sorry if I offend anyone. And finding sweet love. Right? And once you have found that love, you will have progeny, and you need to find somewhere for the kids to grow up. In the fly, this means basically finding fermenting fruit. So it serves as food, it serves as, you know, the nightclub where you find your mate. It's also the place where you're most likely to find danger, and it's also where the kids grow up. To do all of these things, the fly has a number of long-range navigation tools. Oh, actually, I used the term navigation. And they come in multiple different flavors. Flies have vision. They can hear things. Maybe they can sense magnetic fields. Many insects can. Fly, maybe not so well. Many insects can also sense infrared emission. If the fly can do it, maybe not, perhaps. Bees, for example, can sense electric fields. All of these things are super interesting, but it's nothing I work on, right? So we mostly do olfaction. And that's what we've been doing for many years in my lab, and myself many years before that. Okay, so Sophie introduced the olfactory system of the fly yesterday. The business part of the nose, or the business part of the fly in terms of olfaction, or the antennae. They can also sense smells with a number of other organs, the wings, the ovipositor perhaps, maybe even the legs. On the antenna you have the sensilla. The sensilla house olfactory sensory neurons. They express either odorant receptors, which we talked about yesterday, but also members of another gene family, the ionotropic receptors. I'm not sure if this was stressed enough yesterday, but these two gene families have no equivalents in mammals, right? It's a completely unique... This is a completely unique family to insects. This is also found in other invertebrates. So this is very ancient. This family arose with the first terrestrial insects. So the question has been, when did this gene family arise and why did it arise? Latest thinking is that it came with terrestriality. So it's very ancient, 400 million years old.
But you mean a subfamily of GPCRs?
They are not.
GPCRs are ancient, right?
Yes, but this is not a GPCR.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, so unlike the mammalian ones. So It has an inverted membrane topology, for one thing. And whether or not they couple to G proteins is still. So G proteins are likely involved, but they could be involved further downstream. So the signaling cascade is, Craig, what do you say? I guess it's unknown. It's debated.
Let's just say they're certainly ionotropic receptors.
That's for sure. Yeah. If they're metabotropic as well, that's. I'm a co-author on a paper that says they are. Which doesn't necessarily mean it's true, even though it's published in Nature and all. But yes, and also this Play-Doh model here is obviously not entirely true, or it's not. We basically don't know what they look like, right? We don't have a crystal structure. We don't know their conformation. So they form channels. Most likely, it's required four of these subunits, the ORCO subunits, which then are coupled. This complex is then coupled to a unknown number of tuning receptors. So maybe it forms like eight of these units together. Where the other molecules bind in, we don't know, etc. These are more trivial, I should not say, but they are metabotropic or ionotropic.
They're also ionotropic.
Ionotropic receptors, right.
That's the name indicates.
Yeah, that's the name indicates, yeah. And they are distantly related to glutamate receptors. Okay, so nevertheless, the conformation of these things, this is what the fly has. This is the adult fly. This is what is expressed on the antenna. In addition to these, they have a number of other so-called ionotropic receptors, IRs, which detect temperature, humidity, and maybe other things as well, but those are the ones we know. But these are the olfactory ones. And over the years, work from, I would say, mainly John Carlson, others, we have contributed some. We have a very good picture of what these odorant receptors do. So we know the ligands. I should say, except for two, OR23A and OR2A, no matter how hard we have tried, we have never found anything that will bind to these. Sophie's talk yesterday, she mentioned the DA, this sensory neurons expressing this targets the DA3 glomerulus in the antenna lobe. And these are the ones for which you found no connections. So it basically bypasses the mushroom body, goes straight to the lateral horn, and inside the lateral horn, the arborizations of these neurons looks a bit strange. Is it a functional receptor? I mean, no, it's just lost. We don't know. But you can look at the genomes of different flies. You compare, you can see that this gene is under purifying selection. So if it had lost function, we would not expect that. So presumably it's functional, and presumably it does something seriously important. What is that? Well, here's the question, right? It's a bit hard. So this one we mentioned yesterday, the Josmin receptor, OR56A, it is. It exclusively responds to this chemical, doesn't respond to anything else. So there are, I don't know, no one knows how many other molecules there are in nature, right? If you go to somewhere in the forest, no one has really estimated how many. We usually say there are hundreds of thousands. I don't know if that's true or not, but there are certainly thousands and thousands. So if you have an orphan receptor, where do you start, right? If it's highly specific, it can be anything. But this one, we were a bit lucky, I should say. So we need to be lucky again here, and we need to be lucky there again. So how do you figure that out? Well, you figure it out by kind of thinking like the fly does. What's important to a fly, right? So we know they eat fermenting fruit. We know they avoid parasitoid wasps, et cetera, right? So among those things, you can imagine that the ligands are. So, of course, these are the primary ligands for each of these receptors. It doesn't mean that they can only sense this, right? So, let's say OR43A responds to methyl indole, kind of a nasty-smelling chemical found in fecal matter, for example. It also can be activated by other chemicals. So, you can plot curves like this. A bunch of receptors, you can see that some are very narrowly tuned, others are more broadly tuned. So these are like relative responses. So it's not spikes per second or anything. So it could be, for example, that there is a ligand that is super efficient for this one, but it wasn't show up here. So this is what we know so far. So you can do the same. I think there was a question yesterday if there were any chemicals that would activate a large number of receptors. And here you can see, for example, one hexanol activates quite a number of different odorant receptors. Right, so here is the other way around. You have an odorant receptor and you have chemicals, and here you have a single chemical and a number of receptors being activated. Whereas you see, for example, carbon dioxide almost exclusively activate one type, uranyl acetate another, water one, etc., etc. Right?
The negative part is inhibition?
Yes. And we see that with quite a number of chemicals. And the functional importance of this is a bit unknown. Huh? I think there's been a couple of papers published suggesting it's important for a variety of functions, but no one else might know better.
Is this in vitro or sensillar recordings?
These are sensillar recordings, yeah. This is from a database established by Giovanni Galizia, and it's called the DOR, Drosophila olfactory odor response, maybe. I don't know.
This is not the the MG thing.
It's a combination. It's a meta-analysis of everything published about. So that's why there are relative responses.
Now, the inhibition that you see, in some sense, it could be the tip of the iceberg, all pun intended, right? It could be sucking out some amount from all the so-called excitatory responses, too. Has anybody measured, or is it possible to measure neural responses to odorants by blocking inhibition to see how much role they might be playing?
In the fly, it should be, technically, I guess. Yes. Anyone else knows it? How would you? Yes.
But so, also, it's much easier to measure a positive response than a negative response.
It is, yeah.
Spontaneous activity of those neurons is very, very low. So.
Yes. So these are, I would say, these are probably the obvious cases, right, where you see it.
But definitely some olfactory cues suppress the spontaneous
activity. Yeah, that yeah. And
which is really different from the taste system. That doesn't happen at all.
The carbon dioxide neurons are also inhibited by a range of chemicals, and that's been suggested to have a functional relevance. I mean, I'm sure it has, right? Because some chemicals really strikingly inhibit the neuron, and why wouldn't that carry some form of information? But what it does is a bit.
And not to add confusion, but just to sort of confuse me with Mike was asking. So if you also have multiple ligands at the same time, you can actually get competitive inhibition back. I don't know, certainly the muscle, so you have a paper, you can get competitive inhibition. And mammalian. Vertebrate ones, it's not been studied very well. I think many of us are interested in it. In insects, I think there are a couple of papers, right? Just saying that
yes. There are several papers, but I'm not sure there is a consensus. And we show this, you know, and this is actually quite remarkable. This is the only insect for which we have, or only animal for which we have this kind of data, right? And the mouse, it's well, you have 1,000 odorant receptors to start with. And for human, I think it's all of them have been deorphaned. I'm not sure if it's published yet, but that's been done.
But
yep.
That's not valid data because it's not all in vitro and it's not.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
So it's
cell culture. Yeah. So it's a bit.
Don't trust human data.
Well, that's a bit harsh for the students here. Maybe you don't. It's done in cell culture, right? And who knows if it accurately copies the actual mechanism? But
you could argue the same to some degree with Drosophila because it's in the empty neuron system and not really recapitulate the response.
Yeah, so what's done here, for those of you not familiar, you can misexpress the odorant receptors. We have something called the empty neuron. Suppose it's not empty, It's just missing the tuning receptor. So you can drive expression of any given receptor in there, and you can record it. Again, though, if you compare the response in the empty neuron system with the wild-type response, I would say 99% of the cases, this looks very similar. So I think this is exciting, and that we have this type of data. We can do a lot with it, right? And people have done a lot with it. And, next animal for which we will have this type of data, I guess, would be Aedes.
Great. One thing that's interesting to think about is that carbon dioxide in water is also sensed through the gustatory sense, very significantly. Yeah, darn very. You know, there are very few receptors in the olfactory system, but there are also receptors in the gustatory system.
And again, if you compare to mammals, so there is like a little zoo of gene families accomplishing chemosensation in mammals. In insects, it seems to be primarily odorant receptors, a few specialized gustatory receptors, and ionotropic receptors. So we're pretty sure, or I would guess that it's unlikely we will find any other large gene families involved in chemosensation. I mean, you should never say never. But we're kind of running out of neurons where these things would be expressed, right? There are a few mystery places like wings and antenna, ovipositor, so the egg-laying apparatus. Okay, so all of this, super interesting. What we've been working on for ages is the logic to this, you know? You have all these receptors to attune to these specific chemicals. But what is the ecological significance, right? So why has the fly decided to detect these chemicals and not others? How does it help the fly to find food, to avoid danger, to find love, and to find somewhere to lay eggs, right? So they have this 60 or so chemosensory channels tuned to specific chemicals. Why these chemicals? Why not something else, right? So not only like to say what is what, but again, given that everything takes place on a fermenting fruit, to separate all these things from each other is not entirely trivial. What is dangerous can also be good, and you have to weigh, you know, how dangerous is it? How hungry am I? Like Matthew talked about yesterday, the starving larvae. They will go for anything. I think except the endoparasitoid wasp pheromone. Then they go the other way around. Okay, so this is what we do, and this is what we've been doing for a long time, right? And so, what is our contribution? I would say it's this, right? When I made the slide, I thought it would look more impressive, but unfortunately, it doesn't. So we figured out the precise ecological significance and the function of a number of channels. And what do I mean by this? So we can take an example. The example would be OR19A, which detects a chemical called MNC. So, and for those of you working on mammals, flies, other insects, they lay eggs. And that's an important decision for the female to make. So even though, as you said, the larvae, they're fantastic at navigating in nature, I'm not sure how often they actually leave the little fruit home. And how long would they last if they leave the fruit and wander out on the ground? I'm not sure. Has anyone looked? I think they would be carried away by an ant quickly, or eaten. Or nevertheless, so it's an important decision the female has to make. And the fly, they lay eggs on rotting fruit, but do they actually have a preference for something? So I'll do this pretty quickly, just to give you an idea. So what we did is that we provided female flies with a choice of fruit to lay eggs. You can see, given a choice between orange, strawberry, cherry, plum, peach, and cantaloupe, they all lay their eggs, or they mostly lay their eggs in the orange. So we kept the orange, added a whole bunch of other fruits. Still, they prefer the orange. Repeated it with other fruits, still they prefer the orange. Okay, so we can conclude that out of these fruit we test, yes?
This is like a fruit of older?
This is fruit itself, right?
Oh, fruit is, so you prune it, how do you test it?
So, like the mosquito cages you have in your lab, the big ones, we put, actually, how did we do it? We put petri dishes with fruit, basically, in there, and we released, I don't know, a couple of hundred females in each cage, and then we just counted the eggs.
Were they cut or just came?
Mm-hmm. I think they were just chopped up, yeah.
And it's like a routine, or how do you, like, just control the fruit, like, state, like a condition?
Good question. We almost said. No, we avoided using rotting fruit, we used fresh fruit.
Okay.
You cut open the orange?
Yeah, so you just chop it up a bit and we left it there. And the thing is that the flies, they carry their own food. So they're covered in yeast. So you give them a few days and they will inoculate all the fruit with yeast, and so they will provide food for the kids. So, Michael.
Does it make sense for an animal from Africa to prefer a fruit from Asia?
I will come to that. you're smart, yes. Okay, sorry.
This is a pH response.
Yes, I will address that as well. All right.
The orange seems to have more juice than the other fruit. Like the water content is more than the other fruit. Would that be a...
Well, then kiwi?
I think that's maybe an American perspective with your fine Florida oranges. We live, as I said, in Sweden, close to the North Pole. The oranges we get are not as juicy, I might say. So I don't know what is native fruit to our fine country. Not even apple, I think.
There could be a texture component in the selection.
There is. And we know that the flies... will I address this? I will, but I can mention it now. Yeah, when they lay eggs, the females, they like corners, and they like crevices and cracks and things like this. So yes, could also be that if you chop up an orange, it provides more surface area where the flies could do it. Unlike if you cut open, let's say, a banana or something. Yeah, but I will show. I will come to it. All right.
About the rotting process. If you take any of these fruits now, they and compare different states of decomposition, did the fly show preference? Fresh, day one, day two, day three.
Yeah, they will prefer the fruit when it has reached basically peak alcohol content, which happens after, depending on the fruit, but usually after a couple of days. Yeah. So it cannot be too rotten. Or it cannot be too fresh. Yeah, sorry.
So would this same preference, the profile, be there if they were looking for food?
Yes.
So they prefer or to eat orange also.
No, they don't eat anything from the orange. They would eat the yeast. So, but they would probably use the which I will come to. They use the chemical cues from the orange, and they associate that with the suitable. General. Well, what do we know? That's how we interpret it, I should say. Yeah. Okay, so we analyzed the chemical content of all of these fruits, particularly orange, of course. We did a lot of single cell serum recordings, functional imaging, behavior, forward genetics, reverse genetics, etc., the usual hoopla. And what we figured out is that they really... Okay, now maybe I went a little bit too easy on the experimental details for this course here, but... Trust me when I say they really like orange, right? And this preference is mediated, it seems, by chemicals that contain this feature. This is a terpenoid structure, or a terpene structure. And these terpenes, the chemicals with this structure specifically activate OR19A. And here's the striking thing. If you silence the OR19A population, the preference for orange is completely gone, right? So in spite of all these other things, structure, pH, you name it, right? You take away just this subpopulation, it's a handful of sensory neurons on the antenna, and you provide the flies with the choice between banana and orange, they will no longer go for orange, in spite of this being like a really strong innate preference. Yes?
Did you try any organ mutants?
We did.
they also have a completely decreased?
Yes, they do. So let's see which. We have a quadruple mutant that lacks basically everything. They are not super healthy because they have no sensory input whatsoever, but they also show they don't show the preference. So we could rule out taste, and we could rule out a number of other things. Yeah. Okay, so to me, this is quite striking. We see the same thing with OR56A and Jocelyn. So you have a really nasty fruit all covered in this horrible fungus that is really toxic to the flies. You just silence a single neuron population, and the flies go there happy as there was nothing. We did another similar series of experiments, but instead of having fruit, we tested, fecal matter, maybe is the correct term here, from a huge variety of mammals. That was not so popular in the lab. Well, the whole thing started out that we had dog shit in the lab for another reason. I thought, let's try that with the flies and in the egg-laying assay. And we saw, they didn't like it. And then I contacted the zoo, and we got like enormous amounts of crap from all kinds of animals, and we tested it. And interestingly enough, it turns out the flies, they really hate lion. Right? But most of the other, feces, they don't mind it. And even giraffe, they like. Yeah? And that's also dependent on a single odorant receptor population called OR71A. So if you silence OR71A, these neurons, the flies will happily lay eggs on lion crap. And it smells ungodly, right? And it must smell horrible to the flies as well, but still. And of course, this is, this day and age, this is perhaps not super surprising, but you think of Ronkonopka and Seymour Benzer's classic experiments with the time mutants, where they for the first time showed this, you just silence a single gene and a complex behavior is gone. It's to me, it's still mind-boggling. Yeah.
So I just want to know, this preference only for egg-laying also, or like it's also, for example, males also have this preference, and if you mutate the OR19A in males, whether this if they also have this preference, they will go, or it's just for egg-laying preference?
We talked about this yesterday, some of you here, right? We essentially only test egg-laying because it's a quite robust behavior. So we could do T-maces, we could do open arenas, we could do everything, yeah? And it's unfortunately a little bit what type of assay you use. You get, you can get whatever result you want, if they like it, if they hate it, if they ignore it. Yeah? So my guess is that the males would go where the females are. Okay, so what is the ecological significance of this? We haven't addressed this, right? We just show that they like orange. Why would they like orange? Well, there are something called endoparasitoid wasps. I mentioned them a few times. So this is the main enemy of flies in nature. So they looked at a vineyard in southern France and the wild population of Drosophila melanogaster. And it turned out that 80% of the larvae were infected by parasitoid wasp larvae. So this is basically what they die from. So these endoparasitoid wasps, they really don't like orange, right? Why is that? Well, it could be as simple as the fact that they have this thick epicarp that makes it difficult for the parasitoid wasps to find the larvae. So the larvae can simply just crawl under the thick skin of the orange, and they are safe and happy. And I should say that these terpene chemicals that activate 19A, they're specifically produced by the rind. So it's not produced by the thick rind. So basically, you can substitute orange for anything with the thick skin, like orange, that likely will produce the terpenes. So, well, and this brings us to what Michael was alluding to. The fly comes from here. This we know by now with quite a high degree of certainty. This is numbers here, hidden behind the arrow, they show genetic diversity. Exactly how that's calculated is not so important, but what you can see is the higher the number, the more diverse the population is. And we see an epicenter of genetic diversity somewhere down here. It was published a few years ago by John Poole and colleagues. this was a bit of a surprise. Everyone has assumed that Drosophila melanogaster came from here, because most of the close relatives of Drosophila melanogaster comes from here, right? So everyone thought melanogaster likely came from there as well. No, we don't. They come from down here. Orange comes, as Michael was saying, from Southeast Asia. And it was not introduced. Well, we're not exactly sure when it was introduced. We know it was present in the Islamic world, 500 after Christ. Citrus was quite popular in Roman times, but probably quite a luxury. And nevertheless, when it came down to Africa, you know, who knows, but probably in modern times. So, the preference we see for orange must reflect an ancestral preference. So, back home, they likely fed on something, laid eggs on something, and basically were associated with something that looks like an orange, but is not an orange. So, what could this ancestral host be? So, now, thankfully, you know, the fly is the most... Yes, sir?
Do you know that the wasp originated there also, so that the host parasite, the fly parasite, yes, is ancient?
There has not been any population genetic studies of the wasps, but that's a fair assumption. It's an African species for sure. But today the wasps are wherever the flies are, right? So they're here in the U.S. and they're, I think, yeah, they are, yeah. Okay, so the fly being the fly, right? So we have 100 years of research, so we know what the flies like. We know what the flies don't like. So whatever the fruit is, it should come from this area here. This is roughly the epicenter of genetic diversity. Within this part of Africa, there are two dominant ecotypes. You have Zambezian Miombo woodlands, Zambezian Mopane woodlands. Okay, so the fruit should likely come from this type of habitat. The fruit should have a thick rind, much like citrus. This thick rind should produce terpenes, because that we show that something they like. Also, we can see that the fly's olfactory system is particularly tuned to chemicals with the ester structure, right? So most of the receptors are tuned to esters, so likely the fruit should have esters. As we mentioned, acidity, they like low pH, so it should be thick rind, terpenes, estery, so fruity smell, but also be quite sour. It has to be juicy, right? So the larvae has to move through the substrate, so not a coconut, I almost said, but it should be soft enough for the larvae to move. It should be of suitable size, you know, maybe not the size of a banana perhaps, but it should be a decent size. Not a blueberry perhaps, but something bigger, because the females lay hundreds of eggs. If it's too small, it's not enough for all the progeny to eat, right? It should be sweet. Why sweet? Well, they have a bit of a sweet tooth, but also the sugar provides fuel for the alcoholic fermentation, and this is really important. Drosophila melanogaster, unlike most other drosophilids, have a super high tolerance for alcohol. So it provides them with a competitive advantage against essentially all other drosophilids. And finally, and this I will come to, I hope, it likely should be tasty to humans as well. Why? Drosophila melanogaster today is a human commensal. So somewhere in the history of this species, they must have crossed paths with humans. Otherwise, they would not have made it to a human commensal. So likely, they eat something that we also eat, or something that we ate in history.
Mark, does it have to be available year-round? Or would it be okay if it was seasonal?
It's okay if it's seasonal, probably. And we can see that from other drosophilid species, which have close association with specific fruit, like Drosophila erecta comes from West Africa. Parts of the year, they exclusively feed on pandanus, so screw pines. And that's available for 4 months. Rest of the time of the year, the flies, the population likely crashes. They subsist on whatever else they can find. So it doesn't necessarily have to be present here. No. Okay. So what are the fruit here in these forests? Well, there is a bewildering diversity of fruit. So this is just from one forest in Zimbabwe. You go out there, you have about 60 to 70 species of fruit. And these are fruit which are fruit here used in the culinary sense, right? So not in the botanical sense, but things that we would consider, oh, that's a fruit, right? So not some small flowery fruit or something, yeah? And in these habitats, the biomass of fruit, so this is kilograms per hectare, varies considerably over the year. So from March, or let's say from February to June, you have enormous amounts of fruit, but importantly, fruit is not completely gone over the year. So even if there is something only occurring here, they will have something to eat the rest of the year as well. And if we look at all these species, and what is most prominent here, ficus and a fruit called marula. Now, ficus we can rule out. It's something that the flies eat. They've been recorded from it, or not eat, but it's something that they lay eggs in. But it's an unlikely candidate for a number of reasons, right? It doesn't ferment well. They're not particularly. So you think again, you're here in the US, you go to your farmer's market, you find these nice, big, beautiful figs. You go to Africa, the figs are like really tiny, nasty, and nasty to humans. But not nasty to a huge range of other insects that are highly specialized on figs. So they would face stiff competition on figs. That makes it unlikely that it is. Marula, however, is an interesting candidate. So, what does marula look like? Well, first of all, they actually do have a thick rind. It encapsulates a soft pulp. The size is suitable as well. We performed chemical analysis. We could see that it contains a wide range of chemicals, and it's actually dominated by two things, as predicted, esters and terpenes. Now, if you compare the chemical composition to a citrus, this is the main ester chemical. It's called ethyl isovalerate, and the other one, the terpene. I have the terpene structure there. There's some other stuff as well, but nevertheless, it's a terpene. It's called beta-carophyllin. If we compare the chemical composition then with an orange, we can see that they almost exclusively contains terpenes. So basically, it's like an orange where you have added esters. Okay, and what about alcohol content? Well, it's very popular with many animals in the area, including monkeys. And it actually reaches 4 to 5% alcohol content in nature, right? So monkey eat, monkey pass out. And this has been well studied. You can Google it, marula and elephants. You see the elephants eating marula and getting drunk. These are great movies. I hate to ruin this here, but they actually, when they made those movies, they were actually prepping the fruit with vodka. So, not entirely true, so it's been debated whether or not animals actually get drunk, because they calculated how much marula an elephant would need to eat, and it was like the room full here. So. But certainly smaller animals and smaller mammals like monkeys certainly get intoxicated from it. And the fruit is also sour, so the pH is around the same as an orange. It's a bit slightly lower. And finally, it's also an important commodity for people in the region. So people eat it, people have ate it for a long time, and they eat the fruit itself, but most importantly, they eat seeds, which are extremely healthy and nutritious, and you can basically live from this stuff. So if you eat the fruit flesh and then you eat the seed, you're good to go, right? You don't need to eat anything else. And actually, I was here at the local supermarket. You could buy marula shampoo and marula conditioning. Yeah. So it's apparently good for your hair as well. And you can also make amarula liquor. My grandmother, God bless her, she turned 98 and passed away, but she, last years of her life, she drank a bottle of amarula liquor a week, roughly. And she, as I said, she became 98, so it has enormous health benefits. So, okay, if we just go through this, we can see yes. Right, it's from the right region. It contains, it has a thick rind, terpenes, esters, acidic. It's acidic, it's juicy, and it's certainly the right size. It has lots of sugar. It ferments extremely well, and it's quite tasty. Yeah. Good. Okay, so we can do the same exercise with all these other fruits, and I will spare you. So, is there anything else that fits? Not really. Okay, so the important question here, I mean, in theory, it's the perfect fruit, right? So the important question is, do flies even like it? So we did again our little oviposition assay. Again, we repeated our old experiments, and thank God we could repeat it. Given the choice, banana versus orange, flies clearly prefer to lay eggs on the side with the oranges. We did the same thing, now testing marula against orange, and voila, they prefer the marula, right? And so I showed a slide there with all the different fruits. Apart from those fruits, we tested tons of other things, right? And we have so far never had anything that beat oranges, and this is the first one. So, very good. Okay, so, yes?
If you dose the oranges with asters, do you get sort of equal preference? Like, can you
just... yes, that experiment is coming. Yeah, don't spoil my talking. Oh, sorry, you're more than welcome to interrupt, of course.
Can I interrupt? So, I mean, here's
the pants. Yes.
So, how do you do this acid? So, you have people look under a microscope at an orange and count the number of eggs.
Yeah, in this case, as you can imagine, there are some error margins there to find the eggs. And it takes forever. So what we do instead is we take either normal fly food or agarose, and we just put the fruit in a blender and we mix it. And then it's a lot easier to count the eggs. We did the same with the poop, yeah. So that was not very popular. We did a lot of human samples as well, and that was even worse. Yeah. Not included in the paper because, okay, now we're done. Yeah. There was something else? No?
The OI is, again, it's classic.
Oviposition,
yeah.
Banana
over total.
Exactly, okay. Yeah. Okay, so if we look at the chemicals, so the beta caryophyllene, not surprisingly, if you add that to the mix, it confers oviposition. This chemical we tested before, so we knew it already. But what about the ester? This we haven't tested before. It's the same thing. So these two chemicals both mediate positive egg laying. Okay, so if we look then at the difference between an orange and a marula in terms of chemistry, we see this difference in the content of these esters. So, I mean, we have to be Sherlock here. Well, as you said, what happens if we add ethyl isovalerate to an orange, and we test it against a marula, and voila, they no longer show the preference. So basically, it's enough to add this single chemical to the orange, and then the preference is gone. Okay, so we're back to this, right? We want to know where in the nervous system is this mediated, right? Which receptors? So we could...
When you add these chemicals, are you adding at a near natural abundance?
Or yes. Yes. So we do something called solid phase microextraction, right? And you can estimate the release rate of any given chemical, and we try to add it as close as we can. There's a room full of physicists here, so of course the precision by which we do this is nowhere near what you do at CERN or wherever else, I guess. But I mean, we're ballpark close, I should say. Yeah. So this beta caryophyllene, actually we already tested. We know what it reactivates. It activates OR19A. Ethyl isovalerate, based on the structure, and thanks to the fact that Drosophila melanogaster has been extensively investigated, we can have a pretty qualified guess what would activate it, and that would be OR22A. So we took OR22A sensory neurons from the putative promoter of OR22A. We expressed the GCAMP, which is a calcium-sensitive sensor, and performed functional imaging, and we can see that when we stimulate with ethyl isovalerate, we see a strong response. We can stimulate these neurons with marula fruit. We see a strong response. And nicely, if we stimulate with oranges, we see no response whatsoever, right? So these neurons respond to marula chemicals. Now we're quite happy because OR22A is important. Why is it important, right? If we look at this, I mentioned this species already, Drosophila recta from West Africa. They feed exclusively on they preferentially feed on pandanus when pandanus is available. What we see there, we see an increase in OR22A expressing neurons. So they have more OR22A neurons on the antenna. Why? Because the main chemical of the pandanus actually activates OR22A. A classic example almost is Drosophila seychellia, the species that Sophie mentioned yesterday, native to the Seychelles, feeds exclusively on Morinda. Again, we see the same thing. They have more OR22A expressing neurons. And that was also what Sophie found in the mushroom body, that the OR22A is overrepresented. And interestingly, here is another Drosophila, even though the name doesn't suggest it. It's called Scaptomyza flava. They actually don't feed on fruit at all. They are leaf mining the larvae. And what happened there? Well, they don't have OR22A at all. So if you look at this list of odorant receptors, basically they have the same stuff as Drosophila melanogaster. The only thing differing is the lack of OR22A. So basically, OR22A is likely.
So what's the story there? So then why would you remove it? Or was it cerogene now? Or what's?
I don't think it's even present. No, it's a suited
gene. So there's a selection pressure against having it. So there must be expression of another receptor.
Yes, they do. Yeah. So they lost OR22A and a few select others which are closely associated with chemicals coming from alcoholic fermentation.
So I guess the follow-up, what do you think the cost is there? What's the selective pressure to lose it?
So they have a limited number of input channels. I think all of them are important. This depends a bit how you perceive that they decode their environment, right? If it's a purely combinatorial code, it doesn't matter, right? But if each channel has some kind of important function in itself, I think you need to keep them all, right?
But you're building the selective pressure to keep something, right? Because mutations happen all the time.
Yeah, there is a genome. I just forgot if it's a pseudogenized. I would guess there are. But yes, even if it might not be detectable as present, right? It's too far gone down the drain.
Could it be that there are other fruits in that environment which have predators?
Which species are we at now? We're at
the one which lost.
So they don't eat fruit at all.
Yeah.
So they only lay eggs on leaves. And yeah. I don't know what the adults eat. Sap.
Yeah, no, I was referring to the question: what is the selective pressure to lose it? It's possible that their major predator is on fruit that.
Yes, that could be. Will I show it? Maybe if I time. So we have data looking at selective pressure on all the odorant receptors across melanogaster, and you can see majority of these are under very strong purifying selection. A handful of them are under either relaxed selection or strong selection to differentiate between populations. I'll show it. Okay, so. OR22A is important to find food, in this case probably rotting fruit, and it's also important to find the right host. And basically, out of all these odorant receptors, this is likely the one that governs precisely the host, right? Okay, so this is Copenhagen, this is, I think, Chicago, Paris, somewhere nice. Japan, Moscow, and Santa Barbara. These are fantastic places, all of them. They have a few things in common. Drosophila melanogaster is all over here, right? All these nice places, they're here. But one thing that is certainly not around are the marula. So it's an African fruit. It's occurring in a quite a restricted geographic range. So what we have studied are lab flies. They still have this preference, right? They have not seen a marula for, and I will come to that, but 10,000 years, maybe, at least. So they still have this preference. So why would then this OR22 area said is the host designator, right? How could that still be tuned to a marula chemical? It shouldn't be, right? So flies in Santa Barbara, I don't know what you grow here. Grapes, and yeah, everything grows here, right? So the flies here, they feed on something else that contains probably some ester chemical that activate OR22A. We would expect them not to detect this ester, marula ester, but something else. So we can actually look at this. So we looked at populations across Africa from all these places. We have maybe about 1,000 fly genomes. And we can look at OR22A, and these are circus plots. I don't know if you know what that is. So this is, that's Rwanda, and that is Gabon. You see there's a thick red line. That line indicates that there is a difference between these two populations. The darker the color basically means that it's more likely to be a statistically significant difference. So these lighter lines, it could be by pure chance, otherwise it's not. And what you can see that essentially all these populations differ from each other, right? So OR22A at each of these locations is slightly different, which means that there could be some local adaptation with this gene. We can look at the other receptors. So this is a tandem paralog of OR22A. It's called OR22B. You see the same pattern. And then we go a little bit further down the chromosome. We have another, other odorant receptor, and this is OR22C. And you can see that basically there is no difference. And we can do this for all the 60 odorant receptors. And basically they all look like this, except this. Meaning that here you have signs of local adaptation. Okay, so this locus 22A, 22B is interesting in itself. So this is, right, they're very closely related, these two genes. It's a fairly recent application. In melanogaster, the lab strains we have, it's unclear if this gene is functional, it's expressed, but no one has really shown a function for it. In several of the African strains, we find a curious deletion allele. So it's a mix between OR22A and 22B. So what happened is that this chunk from here to here has been deleted, and a chimeric receptor has been formed. And where is this chimeric receptor found? Well, we can see that it's predominantly found down in the southern part of Africa, where we have marula fruit. Whereas in France, right, basically these are the closely related strain to the ones we use in the lab. So Cantonais, it comes from Ohio, Canton, Ohio. But nevertheless, it carries a large proportion of genes or genetic material from this population. So the further south in Africa you go, the more of this deletion allele do you have. So what we can do is we can record from these flies, and we can test it with this marula ester. And voila, what happens? Well, indeed, actually, this is the Cantonese strain, SLA isovalerate and SLXanate, which is the primary ligand of OR22A that is known. It's about the same, but in these African lines from southern Africa, we see that they respond much better to this marula ester. So indeed, there is local variation. Okie dokie. So everything I talked about so far, except this last part, right, has been done with these lab strains. A variety of white 1118s, Cantonais, and an assortment of transgenic flies. But what about wild flies? So to do that, we need to find wild flies. This is a classic easier said than done. Yeah? So people have looked, and they have looked, and they have looked for decades in West Africa, predominantly. You go to Africa, you stay at a nice resort, you put out traps, you put them in your garden, you only catch Drosophila simulans. You put the traps inside the kitchen at this nice resort, you catch Melanogaster. You go 100 meters out in the forest, you catch a shitload of Drosophila flies, but zero Drosophila melanogaster. And that's been the pattern for 30 years. Right? They are strictly human commensal, also in Africa. So what we need to do, of course, is to find the wild population. And we need to find them living in a native, undisturbed habitat. So we did so. We went to Kafue National Park in Zambia. It's an enormous natural park. It's the size of, I think, Rhode Island or something. We went there in the middle of nowhere. We put out traps. And we got one male. That's like a $25,000 fly. Completely useless, of course. If you find one, I mean, how can you say? Maybe it just came there by chance. It was a poacher who brought a banana. On the banana was a fly, right? If you find one, one is nothing, almost. Well, it's better than zero, for sure. And actually, we tried to publish this single fly, and you can imagine. In Current Biology, even though the editor is a good friend of mine, it didn't really work out. We went to Gonaresu National Park in Zimbabwe in 2015. Also a major expedition. One of my students almost died there. Had a severe car accident in the middle of nowhere. Then they actually had to torch the spare wheels of the car so the planes that were sent out to look for her could see her, and that was a huge adventure. Nevertheless, we caught two females, right? So that was like, Jesus Christ, that's another like $20,000 fly. So of course, we have three now, so the price has gone down a bit, but still. And in Swedish, we have a saying, you know, shame to the one that gives up. Skam till den som ger sig. So, I think 2016, we went to Matopos National Park in Zimbabwe. Also, again, huge place, covered in Miombo forests. And now we thought, okay, we really have to find Marula. If we find the Marula, right, maybe we can find the flies. We quickly located Marula. We found fermenting Marula underneath the tree. Okay, so what we did, we took the Marula, put them in plastic bottles. And we placed the plastic bottles underneath the fruiting marula tree. A couple of days later, we checked what we had. And voila, finally, we catch wild Drosophila melanogaster. And we catch quite good numbers. These are just a few days of experiments. And of course, they were finally, we have them. So we can ask these wild flies now. We ask them the same thing, right? You give them a Pepsi challenge. Marula versus orange, what happens? Well, these wild Drosophila melanogaster, they clearly prefer the marula. In these forests, you don't only have melanogaster, in fact, you have a lot more of the closest sibling to this species, Drosophila simulans. So we can do the same thing, we can check, what about Drosophila simulans? You see that they don't make the choice, right? So given a, they don't care, which either way what. So we can conclude that the wild flies, in this case melanogaster, right, they really like marula. Drosophila simulans, they don't exactly dislike it, but they don't particularly like it. So, okay, we found melanogaster wherever we found marula trees. What about if we put the traps at sites where there is no marula? What happens? Well, we only find Drosophila melanogaster where there is marula. Where there is no marula, there is no melanogaster.
You said extremely unsuccessful in expeditions.
Yes.
There was no marula.
There was no marula, there are no flies. And we can look again at simulans, and we can see that where there is marula, they're quite common, but they're as common where there is no marula. So I say every story, every paper has a key figure, key element. And in this, it will be this, right? Out of all these hoopla of experiments, genetics, and shit back and forth, this is sort of part of my language. Yeah. This is the important one, right? It suggests, namely, that Drosophila melanogaster in the wild are specialized. Right? They're not the generalist we always thought. We do experiments. We always do experiments, let's say, with Drosophila sachelia because it's specialized. We include as a control melanogaster because it's a generalist. It's not entirely true. They're actually quite specialized. So it's not a generalist. And as a matter of fact, this is not super surprising because most of the relatives are actually specialized.
Why
so,
why do they have so many receptors in the combinatorial code?
If they're specialized. First of all, Marula is only present for a few months of the year. Other times of the year, they need to find something else to eat. And all Marulas are not equal, right? So some Marulas are probably better in terms of microbial substrate. Some Marulas might contain nasty bugs. You have to decipher between a myriad things. And it's this ethyl isovalerate, although it's predominant in Marula, it's also found in other fruits. So it's not that you can use like a specific chemical to say this is a Marula. You have to have a blend of things that together make for a good Marula.
And so if it's not there the whole year, like how do they survive? Since you've shown that without the fusion and using
It's the same. Okay, now Santa Barbara here is because here it's the same climate all year round, but they're also in Sweden. So in Sweden, we see that the population essentially during winter, it is gone. A few survive in supermarkets. Or if you have someone who doesn't have a very tidy kitchen, will form a reservoir where the flies can stay. As the spring comes in late August in Sweden, spring arrives in May, June, right, the flies will move out into the garden. And as the rotting fruit will amass in the gardens, by the end of the summer, you know, the population explodes and they move into the houses again. And it's probably the same in Africa, right? So during the months where there are no marula, the population dwindles to a minimum. And so apart from these two places, there are three places we searched, colleagues from the States, they also searched for many years. And they had the same pattern. We couldn't find them, right? And we have, so we likely again because we were searching out of Marula season. So okay, so most of the relatives, the point I would like to make is that they are actually specialized. So Melanogaster would just fall into the pattern. So Seychellia morinda, Teisseyeri, it's also another widespread African species on this Farinari fruit, Orienum susugium, Rectum pandanus, and Santomea on ficus.
So when we talk about specialization for some Drosophila species, it sometimes can mean that we really just can't even raise them in the laboratory because we can't find their particular substrate. But here where there's kind of a distinction between that kind of specialization and the specialization where the animal can be raised in the laboratory on roughly whatever you give them.
Yeah, so these species can all do that, right? It's because they... So this is the preferred substrate where they like to lay the eggs, but in essence, they only eat yeast, right? So if you provide them with yeast, they're happy. But they're not maybe super happy, but they're happy enough. You have on the Hawaii, you have thousands of Drosophila species, and they're all extremely specialized, right? They can live on a single flower, and they eat whatever single species of yeast, and they're hopeless to rear. So we went to a few years ago, 10 years ago by now, probably. We went to Cayman Islands to find they're called crab flies. So they're very curious little Drosophila. They live their entire life on terrestrial crabs. So the adults, they sit on the carapace, and then they lay their eggs around the mouth parts, and the larvae develop in basically the land crabs have like mouth parts that open like this, and they have like something that looks like a mustache. And then they have two glands where they secrete their urine. And then the urine passes through the mustache and goes into the mouth again, so they're constantly, you know, to save water, right? Because you're a crab living on land. And this forms like a perfect habitat for the fly larvae. So we went to the Cayman Islands, we found the damn flies. They hadn't been seen they were seen once in 1963. Since then, no one had seen them, so I convinced my boss back then, you know, can I have some money to go to Cayman Islands and find these flies? And we went there, we found them. And then I hadn't really thought out what to do with them once we found them. It was not entirely trivial to keep them in the lab. So we could actually buy land crabs on zoo stores. And so I brought back like a handful of these flies, and we built a huge arena with land crabs. And, you know, that's like screw it. I just opened the bottle and released the flies, and straight they went to the land crabs. unfortunately, the flies did very well. The land crabs, they all died. So we didn't get the call.
But you kind of see the point I was trying to make, which is like...
Yeah, I was just telling a good story.
Yeah. There's a range of generalists to specialists, and when you
it is.
Claim
it is.
The Lancaster to specialist, you mean somewhere in that range that's a bit closer to generalists.
Yeah. It's a seasonal specialist. Okay. Right.
Has Marula been introduced in different parts of the world, and when it has?
It hasn't, It has in Israel, I think. They tried in one kibbutz to rear it. Or not rear it, how do you say it? Rear it, not to...
Oh, rear. Cultivate.
Cultivate, thank you. And I think it worked well. It's surprisingly, because it's an important commodity in Africa, and it's underused, and it has all this magic, like longevity, like my grandma. So, but it would be interesting to check in Israel if they also go there.
So what is the problem, agriculturally, or can it be...
I don't know. Probably, no, I think the experiments in Israel worked very well. And the trees, they produce enormous amounts of fruits, and also it's...
Can they taste well, or what?
No, they taste fantastic. I don't know why, really. Yes?
Do you think that the specialization of the different species is tied directly to the evolution of Aura-22A, or do you think there are other...
There are other things as well. But in all the species where we look, we see that OR22A is important in this context. Yeah. So here we haven't looked, I think. An audience, not to me. Yeah.
In what time frame have they radiated?
It's a bit hard to estimate, but the split is around 20 million for many of these, I think. Yeah. So the relationship up here, it's in spite of us having numerous genomes from all of these, we still cannot really decipher the relationship between these species. But these are quite recent. Yeah. The data suggests that there should be one more species lurking somewhere in Africa, which is, if it's specialized, it might be difficult to find. Yeah.
I was just essentially asking what your special enemy. Essentially, the place where you found Melanogaster
and the Marula trees, where are they? Like Marula trees, not. Do you have any idea? And where they survive? Or the population just crashes on you? Like, flying flowers that survive? We think that the crashes, and maybe what they could switch to are ficus, because ficus is present all year round. And this you see with this species. When Pandanus is not around, they switch to ficus.
So if you would collect the flies in a different season on the other fruit, do you think you get the same result? Would they prefer...
That's a good question. Yeah. Answer is, I don't know. I would guess. But if not, that would be super interesting. Yeah. Okay, that's all I have for
you. So you talked about the diversification of the fly and that it's... higher in that lower part of Africa. Did you look at the justification of the Marula fruit? It's maybe a subspecialization even in different Marula.
We're trying to figure out the distribution pattern of Marula in Africa. It's a bit hard. The literature is scant at best. So we don't know how much they differ, and we don't also know if the subspecies variability among Marula.
So when you go in the field and pick up the flies, do you pick up also the Marula, and then could you analyze basically what's released by this fruit?
Yeah, sure, we did, yeah. They differ quite a lot because, you know, these are fruits that have been laying, so it's a different. Normally we do these experiments, you go to the farmer's market and buy the fruit. You buy orange. And an orange, if you buy from the same Valencia orange, for example, it always tastes the same. I mean, that's the point of it. Or you buy a Dole banana, it's a Dole banana. So these are like clonal things, right? In nature, that's not the case. So one tree can be actually quite different from another tree. And also these have been lying out in the forest. Monkeys have been feeding on them. God knows what else, right? So they differ quite a lot. So. In the end, for this, I think we took one that we suggested this is representative. So it's not a huge difference. It's a kind of ratio of things which are slightly different. Yeah. But the main chemicals are older. Yeah.
So for marula versus oranges, is there a correlation between 3D preference and N-like preference?
Have we looked at that? Now, again, they feed on the yeast. So I don't know if it promotes feeding, really. We haven't looked at that.
Because OR19A is also activated by benzaldehyde, right? Which is a repellent. So there is an aversive pathway there which has been counteracted. Mm.
Benzaldehyde, though, is a tricky chemical. It activates a lot of things. That's highly reactive. And I think in Leslie Wassell's lab, they managed to record responses from dead flies to benzaldehyde. So it's a tricky chemical. So not the best, I think, to the plant actually contains, so the seeds, you know, benzaldehyde is typically found in nuts. It actually also contains benzaldehyde. Yeah. Shall I, am I done? Or? Can I ask the finish by the last thing here? So this is a kind of neat thing. So we have the wild flies. They have to go from the wild to domestic. So maybe the fruit here is the vehicle that made this happen. So this is a cave. And that's me. You can see my nice tan and my body. That's how I look, I'm afraid. Yes. This is a recent photo, but the drawings here, unfortunately again, the drawings on the wall here were made in Upper Pleistocene, Early Holocene, so about 10,000 years ago. So these caves are scattered all over the region. Now, in this area, these drawings were made by now extinct sand tribes that lived in the area from, we don't know exactly when they moved in there, but 30,000 years ago. And they disappear from the archaeological record sometime 5,000 years ago, outcompeted or killed by other tribes. These guys, they ate marula. So archaeological excavations done in the 1960s of a cave called the Pomonga Cave in the area uncovered 24 million marula seeds. So they dug a hole in the cave and they picked up seed after seed after seed after seed. And in the end, it was estimated that during the time when these caves were inhabited, the people brought in something like 20,000 marula per year. Jeez. So when marula was fruiting, these guys, or her ancestors, I should say, they were basically seasonal marula specialists, just like Drosophila melanogaster. So they must have exclusively eaten marula. And as I said, you can do it, right? The fruit gives you sugar and it gives you all the other stuff. The nuts give you all the other good stuff you need. So, right? Could this be something, right? The interaction between these now vanished sand tribes, the marula and the fly, led to the process of domestication. So we can then imagine, right, that this caveman, or not, sorry, I shouldn't call the cave, sand tribe, sand hunter-gatherers, right? They have gathered their nice pile of marula. They sit there for 4 or 5 months and they eat marula. They process it. They probably make some proto-alcoholic beverages out of it, etc., etc. We also see that it was important religiously. It was an immensely important fruit for these people, right? So they sit there. And this, of course, would then, we assume, then attract flies inside. Or alternatively, the flies were already sitting on the marula when they brought it in. So we can do an experiment. So we can take the marula, put them again in some plastic bottle, and we just put the marula inside one of these caves. So in this case, the Naswatugi cave. And what do we see? We see we can compare the ratio of Drosophila melanogaster to Drosophila simulans. Inside the cave, we exclusively have Drosophila melanogaster. We see no simulans. We put the traps just outside the cave, and it's the reverse. So we see basically only simulans. So basically, melanogaster enters the caves. It's a prerequisite. Other insects typically don't. And this is something we still see today, right? So as I said, you go to Africa, you put the traps in your garden, you get simulans. You put the traps in your kitchen, you exclusively get melanogaster. So all other insects that would, let's say an insect finds its way inside here, fly like a big diptera, the first thing it will do is go to that window and try to escape. Melanogaster would be perfectly happy in here. It would look for fruit or, you know, it has like no efforts to go outside. Okay, so Melanogaster go inside. So basically you can have a scenario where you have the marula trees, the flies, they feed on the marula, the sun, they pick up the marula, they bring it into the caves. You have the smell from the marula also attracting flies inside the cave. And inside of this happens something, and out comes a domesticated human commensal. We can actually, the last thing here, and I don't show the data, I just talk about it. So we can actually date this as well via population genetics. So we have all these genomes, and we can estimate the demographics of these populations. When did they split? So we know that these caves, right, you can C14 date these marula seeds, and it's ranged from 12,000 to 8,000 years ago. That's the time when we would expect them to have become human commensals, right? What should we see in the genome? Well, we should see a diversification between southern Africa and other populations. And this is what we see. 10,000 years ago, it seems that Melanogaster left its native land, and it spread extremely rapidly across all of Africa. It actually even crossed Sahara. So we have populations from up here. We see 10,000. We see 10,000 between here, 10,000 between here, 10,000 between here and here. It went very rapidly. Yep.
How does Melanogaster know the difference between marula outside and inside the cave?
They don't, but normally insects would not enter these caves. Melanogaster is the only one that dare to venture inside.
So have you figured out what they use and what is the attraction besides the marula? So it's marula both inside and outside. The human CO2 generation, other things? Or?
Maybe a sheltered environment. We can also see that. So the place where the trees grow, it's very craggy, rocky ground, and the fruit falls in under crevices. So you have to dig out the fruit, and actually the flies, they go inside under there. And there you also found Melanogaster. So maybe they're a bit pre-adapted to seeking out dark places. Yeah, but they're less phototactic than other species. I mean, still they are. We know that experimentally, right? When you work them, it's a pain in the butt. But compared to the other ones, they are actually less. But final word here on this. So 10,000 years ago, they left. Interestingly, they got stuck here. And the switch or the entry into Europe only seems to have occurred in the last 1,500 years or so. Why is that? Well, we can actually correlate this with the introduction of citrus to Europe with the Islamic trade, which occurred around 700 BC. So basically a rapid expansion across Africa once they become human commensals. And then stuck there for a while, and then they made a leap. So this is interesting. So this is new data, and it's actually the old date was that the out of Africa event of Drosophila melanogaster was 12,000 years ago. But it's not true. The out of Africa event is much more recent. But how they did the measurements back then in the 80s was that they compared a population from Europe with one from Southern Africa. So essentially what they measured was the out of the Miombo open forest.
Is it 20,000 or 120,000?
12,000. The old date was 12,000 years ago, out of Africa. And I think what, if I open with some open questions, I think what's really super interesting is the difference here between these two species, right? They're extremely close to each other genetically. I mean, you find clear orthologs of everything. There is virtually no difference in the genome, but they have a fundamental difference in biology. And this is something that is really ripe to examine. Yeah? I've been pushing people, you know, we should do the complete connectome of simulans and see where these differences reside. Yeah? Okay. Oh, done.